This is Bentic, the Atari 8-bit podcast.
It didn't really come out that well. It actually was my first lesson in a failure of something that was fun. Solo developers of the time, their games were sometimes pretty great, but sometimes mostly not. And Electronic Arts brought, because of what Trip Hawkins learned, he brought the Hollywood studio system to the games industry.
This is an interview episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast. I'm Kevin Savitz. Steve Hales published several games with Synapse software: Slime, Dimension X, Fort Apocalypse, and Mind Wheel. His first job was reverse engineering the Atari 2600 to create the StarPath Supercharger. His game for that platform was Suicide Mission, an Asteroids clone. This interview took place on October 21, 2015. In it, we discuss Ihor Wolosenko and Catherine Mataga, whom I previously interviewed, and Mike Potter and Bob Polin, whose interviews are forthcoming. Steve has released the source code for Fort Apocalypse. He and I talked about the possibility of also releasing the code for his other games. In March 2016, he emailed me and said, "I did a deep look into my archives and didn't find anything useful. I have one more place to look, but it's not near me at all, so it will take a few months to look." However, he does have Mindwheel running on a website at mindwheelgame.com, and his more modern game, Squirrel Wars for iOS, is available at squirrelwars.com. That's Wars with a Z. Check the show notes for those links, as well as links to Steve's other projects. Our interview starts with us talking about the recovery and scanning of the Star Raiders source code. Although he didn't create Star Raiders, Steve is the person who found the source code printout for Star Raiders in his files and lent it to me to scan.
So how did the scanning go?
It went well, and
I saw the link of that you sent. Looks great.
Thank you. Yeah, the scanning was super easy. I mean, I just fed it to the sheet feed scanner, and it drunk it up, and then the internet sort of exploded a little bit. people were thrilled at having the Star Raider source code. There's a project going on GitHub to digitize it in the text and put it page by page on the GitHub, and they're working on that relentlessly.
Great.
And then I posted to the Atari Age forums about it, and they were excited. And then Kurt Vendel said, "Oh, well, I have the source code in some other format," and so he posted that. So now, because now people are comparing the two versions, and
nice.
There's all sorts of projects starting now to hack on Star Raiders, and oh, let's make the explosions better, and oh, let's add, people are talking about adding a new level that does, you know, acts differently, and people are thrilled. They're just having a great time with it.
Excellent. Well, it seems like, you know, like, why hadn't it been released? When I had gotten that, it was, I'm sort of trying to remember when I got it. It was 2005. So I guess it's been about 10 years.
So how did you get it?
So I worked at Danger, and we made this T-Mobile Sidekick. They were really one of the first sort of portable social phones. And a colleague there that I won't name, who I got pretty close with, and he worked at LucasArts, and he also worked at Atari during the Star Raiders tenure, and I'm sort of, you know, in general, I'm known to do interesting visual historian things, and he just came into my office one day and says, "Hey, do you want this?" He just. And the thing he said was, "You can't tell anyone when you got it." So that's it. I won't reveal where it came from.
No, got to be true to your word, absolutely.
And then I just stashed it away, not really thinking too much about it. And at the time, I was like, "Well, okay, this, you know, I mean, it's actually somewhat hard, but all of the stuff we all now take for granted." You know, social coding and all that kind of interesting things didn't really exist, right? So it would have been pretty hard to find a forum, right? If you're just posting it straight up, it wouldn't get a lot of notice.
Right.
So I just stashed away, and then I was cleaning out boxes of old software that I've either been part of or worked on, and I found this binder. So that's when I started. My just reached out, and it was great that you kind of stepped up. You were second. So I had one other person, but he didn't respond. He just like ignored me. So it's great.
Well, good. Well, thank you so much for keeping it and for letting me borrow it. And it's still sitting here on my desk. I wanted to make sure that nobody goes, oh, you know, page 32 is missing before I send it back.
Take your time. Right. I mean, it's ultimately my guess would be that, you know, somebody is going to like, at this point, it's like, I'm really curious as to the race of like when somebody's got the original game compiled for the first time from this code running on either an emulator or real hardware. Right. That'll be very interesting to kind of see.
Yeah. People are just so excited by it and looking at the code going, why did he do it this way? He could have, you know, saved a byte by doing it that way. And now, and then it's kind of like, did he not? Because he was writing this on prototype hardware, so it's like, you know, did he not know he could do it that way, or is he smarter than all of the rest of us? And you know, which I think is probably the option that's probably most accurate, is Doug Neubauer knew what he was doing. Since we're talking about source code, I'm going to do this in an unusual order. You have also released the source code to Ford Apocalypse, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. For Atari, the code that's in GitHub is. I had mistakenly thought it was for the original Atari 400, 800, but I believe it's actually for the 5200. That sort of ill-fated console machine that, mm-hmm. that was a derivation of the Atari 800.
So I guess my questions regarding that are, number one, why are you so awesome that you saved the source code and shared it without being asked? And also, where's the source code for Dimension X and Slab?
So considering that this is Back to the Future Day, I have to say that I'm a little mystified as to why my 21-year-old self said, make 5 copies of all this code and stick it in a box. Because I honestly, you know, it's like, well, okay, right? I mean, everything was fragile, super fragile back then. And for whatever reason, I just did it. So I do have code to, and I own the rights to all my games. And I have the code for all of them, I believe. I just haven't got through it yet. So as soon as I find the code for Dimension X and Slime, I'll release it as well. And because I suspect it'll be as interesting. Slime is more. I think it's my favorite game. It has. It was my first kind of game for the 800, and I just sort of fell in love with the hardware, right, and how you do very specific things. And Ford Apocalypse kind of came, it was my first game that I started building, and then I was asked to shift to work on Slime instead. And so I did that, and so which was fine, right? For me, it was all interesting and very 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 fun at the same time.
It was the first game you started building, or was it not?
So Ford Apocalypse was the very first game I was building, wasn't the first one I released, because the founder of Synapse, Ihor Wolosinko, he asked me to divert my attention to this game that he'd already designed with another software engineer, Slime. They had started it, and for whatever reason, he dropped out of it, and I just sort of picked it up and started over. And there was a little bit of design work done. There wasn't really anything that I could use. I ended up having to kind of start over with it. But that was really the first, you know, deep dive. And it ended up actually making Ford Apocalypse better, because when I went back, I had learned a whole bunch of techniques that were, you know, super interesting. You know, how to do very dynamic audio that changed while, you know, when you're moving and doing things like that. And then with Slime, it didn't use any of the scrolling hardware, so I hadn't really explored that much. So when I came back into Ford, the only thing I had to figure out was the scrolling hardware. Like, everything else had already figured out. So it was kind of, it made it easier. It made that game go a lot faster. So Slime took about 6 months, and Ford Apocalypse was about 4.5, with about another month of tuning, where we built a bunch of levels and showed it to people, and it was too hard. So we tuned it down. We made it simpler. We redid the levels.
It sounds like both of those games were done in the way that I think Ihor was famous for, where he had a game in mind, and you just had to implement his vision.
Yes and no. So I was sort of one of the unique. There were a couple of engineers there, software people, who had the ability to express a creative side. And Slime was definitely not my creative. So that was his idea. I added some touches to it that were unique to me. But Fort Apocalypse was mine. I actually when I came to Synapse, that's actually the product I said, this is what I want to build. I had a very distinctive vision, and I even had some prototype work kind of already done. That's what I showed him, and that's actually why he hired me, or you know, brought me on, right? So Slime was just like help us out, right? So for me, it's like, okay, I'll do that because I'm gonna I want you to like me, basically, right? So I did a good job there, and then he let me in, let me do what I wanted, and then it became like this really interesting collaborative relationship because he was able to trust my creative choices, right, and be able to execute.
Nice. But let's go back in time for a minute. Let's start before this stuff. I'd like to hear about reverse engineering the Atari 2600 to create the StarPath supercharger.
So that is a pretty interesting story. So,
actually, let's go back even farther. I mean, how did you even end up there? I mean,
so
tell me, go back to the very beginning. Like,
so I grew up in Livermore, California, and I went to high school I started in the 10th grade there, in a high school called Granada. And it was actually, this was in 1977. And, Granada was actually an experimental school. It didn't use the typical Bell model, right, where everybody had to be in a class. It was an open campus, which meant that, and then we all had homerooms, and so we had the ability to kind of schedule our day, and it was just like we could do anything we wanted. It was completely open. There was no truancy officers, for instance. So what was interesting about that, Livermore Labs, was basically in that city, and part of that school, they also had a declassified mini computer. One of my first exposures to sort of a multi-terminal computer systems, and I got into that program. Basically, I think through an act of my mom's will to just kind of push. And because it was sort of reserved for gifted folks, and maybe I was, I don't really know. I mean, but I got put into this situation where I was into something that I had never, nobody had seen, right? This is 1977. And with that, I basically was introduced to a bunch of people of my peers, and some of these names will sound familiar. Stephen Landrum, Scott Nelson, myself, and a few others that were there that I can't remember right off the top of my head. But these guys basically kind of, as we kind of continued working and playing and experimenting with this stuff, when we kind of all got out of high school, we started gravitating toward, computers in general as careers. And we were particularly interested in video games. Video games were, they were totally weird, right? Like, computers were strange enough, but video games were even another offshoot of weird. So one of the happen chance here was that Scott Nelson's brother, Craig Nelson, he actually worked for Atari. And he created the backgammon game for the 2600. And he had left. He had left Atari, and he started this company called Acorn, which became became StarPath. So he's one of the founders, and so he hired his brother, and because his brother and Steve Landrum, who was also one of the first engineers for Supercharger, they asked if I wanted to be part of it as well. I was just starting college, so I was like 18, 19, and they said, okay, well, because I'd proven myself with my 6502 chops doing Apple II and Atari, kind of experimenting with all that stuff, I basically got into this kind of world that was like, okay, what is this white box reverse engineering? So I actually was taught by Craig how to do white box reverse engineering that's totally legal. And at that time, Atari was incredibly litigious, so they were really, really paranoid about it. So they actually wanted to have basically two guys, me and Stephen Landrum, completely isolated, and we were given hardware that we could poke around at, and we had to write down our findings in a lab book every day. And we did that for months. That took us about 4 or 5 months to kind of reverse engineer it. And that process was a lot of trial and error, right? All what we had the ability to do is we knew it was a 6502. We could load code. We figured out how to load code into it through some hardware hacking that Craig had done. And we basically just wrote programs to poke memory addresses. And we explored every memory address possible. We knew roughly where the hardware addresses were. Craig, because he was an ex-Atari employee, he was totally not able to give us any clues. And it must have been somewhere between, painful and, teasingly hilarious, because we would get close and he would never give us clues, right? He wouldn't tell us anything about what was going on.
Was the point of that and the lab book to be able to prove in court that you were not given any internal documents from Atari or anything, that you did the work yourself?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And that's a legal way to do white box engineering. If you can do that process, a court will allow you to kind of like you have the owner to do that. Decades later, that happened to Sega. Sega lost it because of actually my business partner, Jim Nichols, who did the same thing to Sega, ended up working he was working for Electronic Arts doing exactly the same thing. So there's, there's the commonalities of our story intertwines, it's really interesting. It definitely takes a certain kind of person that is interested in doing that kind of reverse engineering. But eventually we figured it out, and we got to the point where we roughly understood the hardware, we roughly understood like various memory locations, we knew that we had to actually write code to control the vertical lines and the V-sync and horizontal control. And then we started experimenting. We figured out how you could actually write code to interrupt as the scan line was scanning horizontally and change the hardware registers, something even Atari didn't even know you could do. But we were able to prove it, and this is how we did a bunch of really interesting games where we got more imagery on the screen than actually was sort of typically possible. Activision, of course, did the same thing with, they did it a little differently. They had actual ex-Atari people that were part of it. I don't remember the actual timeline. But eventually we created our own book. We created our own rule book on how to do stuff, documented it very deeply. And then at that point, that's when Scott Nelson came on board, and we just handed him the book. Like, he didn't do it. He just got the instructions on how to write code, right? How to write control registers. And then we all started, it was Scott Nelson came on board and two other guys came on board and we just started building games at that point. And we did the classic kind of, platform launch business model, which is, okay, we're going to do 5 games, one of each genre, see which one sticks. So we just chose five different styles of games. And whoever was interested in the particular one would just take it on. So for me, I was interested in Asteroids. Steve Landrum was interested in Galaga, and you know, there were, and Steve Landrum was interested in adventure games, right? And that, so, and that's kind of, you know, where kind of, where it came from, where all these kind of pieces came from. And then after that, I basically finished up those projects, and that's when I was approached by Ivor. And so I'd only been at StarPath for maybe a little over a year, and no particular reason, but I like to explore ideas. I've never really worked more than 5 years at any one company in my entire career, so I like to kind of just gather and experience things. So Ihor basically was interested in talking to me about doing games for the Atari computers, and I had a high school friend, Mike Potter, who had already been working with him, and he vouched for him, and I met him in Berkeley where Synapse's offices were, and then that kind of started that next completely different chapter, right? And then StarPath ended up getting purchased by Epix, and that became that core group became the core of the Epix software company. And then eventually they became 3DO, and you know, there's a whole bunch of other cadre of people that were part of that. RJ Michael, one of the creators of the Amiga, you know, and Handy, and all these, and then that team also ended up building the Atari Lynx. If you remember that machine, so it's like this, you know, this area where I was just happen chance was the sprout of like a huge chunk of the early computer games industry. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Ihor asks you to jump over to Synapse, and so you were an employee there at Synapse as opposed to a freelancer.
So at that time. So I was an employee of StarPath with a sort of traditional model that we think of today, right? I was an employee with stock options and all that stuff. And Synapse the games industry at that time was pretty much a sort of book publishing model. So I was basically given a royalty contract, a relationship contract like that, and if I needed it, I could take advances on it, but I didn't need it at the time. So I was not an employee. I was just a contractor. But I had, I had royalties, and this was typical, right? This was before Electronic Arts entered in the scene. And everybody was like that. I was probably one of the tail end of people at Synapse who actually made a pretty good living with it, but it was definitely, I had missed the boat by a couple of years. In terms of the big money, right? The big money was definitely earlier. And eventually, after a couple of years, I became an employee and then was just part of Synapse for about 5 years, I think, until they kind of finally crashed.
Okay, so you started on Ford Apocalypse and then you did Slime.
Yep.
You sort of already told about that. Are any other stories we need to know, the world needs to know about Slime?
Well, yeah, there's a fun one. So the whole kind of tone of Slime is the aliens are these, they speak to humans as like carbon units, and they use this sort of funny language. That's all my kind of crazy humor that I kind of brought to the party. And we named the aliens Plexarians.
Who would show up in many other games.
That's right. And that name came from Ihor. So so that was something that he and I liked to do, is we'd word riff on things. And, he was a good, he was 35, 36 at the time, had a multitude of careers, actually, full kind of experiential careers before he started doing software. So he was significantly more educated than I at the time about this stuff. So it was a lot of fun. I learned a great deal from being a collaborator with him. And then, yeah, that name, we sort of broadcast it in other, we stuck it in other games in fun ways.
All right. So since we're talking about it, let's talk about that. So Plexarians were in that game. And then in Ford Apocalypse, there's a message, Plexar was here.
Yep.
And
there's one in Dimension X. And it's, so Dimension X is a weird game that where you're traveling through these sort of blocks, sector blocks, and you go through these tunnels. And there's one, and I don't remember how to trigger it, but there's one block that you go through. When you go through the tunnel, you get a Plexar was here message. But I don't actually know how, I've forgotten how to trigger it. It doesn't happen every time. And then it appeared in one other game that had nothing to do with Synapse. It was actually my cousin Brian Hales, who's about 10 years younger than I. He also got into the games industry, and he was working for a company in doing some Atari ST games. And he was sort of a 3D graphics expert. So he built like some kind of space simulator, and I don't even remember what it was called, but it had Plexar was here in it as well. But it didn't really have any success, so nobody really saw it, and the company kind of disappeared. So that's the history.
All right, so Ford Apocalypse, and that's a just awesome game, and I'm wondering if you said you went to Synapse with a vision of what the game was to be. Did it come out? Was it the flavor that you expected? I mean, did it come out like you wanted?
It wasn't as rich. My vision of it was basically, you know, daydreams and dreams of the time. And I had I'm kind of a sketcher, so when I wake up, I'll sketch things. And I have these early sketches that I've drew, what that world looked like. And they were pretty rich, right? Richly detailed. And of course, the Atari ST or the Atari 400 and 800 was, pretty low resolution, so you couldn't really do too much. The colors were right, though. There's been a number of interesting reviews about that game where people were reacting to the sort of core base colors. And I don't particularly know why I chose those, but those colors, the sort of bright red, green, and those blue, and they are not, by the way, they're not straight up RGB full-on colors. There was something else slightly different about them. But they were in the imagery that I had drawn, so that's why I chose them. So, if I ever do that game again, if I'm ever able to, it would definitely be, I'd love to be able to do it in a much more richer way. Years later, I was working with some other colleagues, and we were actually starting down the path of designing a reboot of the game for the Amiga. And we didn't get too far. We got a lot of design work done. We figured out how to make it multiplayer, which would have been really, really interesting. We also changed the point of view. I think we were moving it toward contemplating doing it in full 3D. We didn't really think we could do the performance though. But we were also experimenting with top down, which there's a lot of games like that that it does work really well. So, but we didn't get too far. We just had the design. I still have that work, but. So maybe someday.
Nice, that'd be awesome. You said you said you released the source code of the Ford Apocalypse for the 5200. I assume the 5200 version isn't really that different from the 8-bit version, joystick tweaks and that sort of thing.
That's correct. Yeah. It's basically just memory address locations and. There's some cartridge hookup. There's some stuff you got to do at the where the cartridge locations are to kind of make the game boot up. But the binary disk versions are pretty much the same. Even it still has the same bugs. There's a bug that even transferred over to the Commodore 64 version. We never really fixed it. So
what's the bug?
Oh, and actually, the bug is, when you're shooting the little robots that are flying, they have this kind of character graphic explosion where you see it sort of static as they're exploding. Sometimes that explosion will get stuck in the world, and if you fly into it, you'll die. So So that particular, and that bug, you know, it's basically some logic error with how the objects are removed from the tile maps or from the world. And that bug, of course, is in the Commodore 64 version as well.
Okay. Do you think you have the code for the 800 version around in your piles of disks?
I might have the code for it, but it's hard to determine whether or not it's... one of the things about it, right, I had five copies of all the disks, and out of each pair, I lost one disk. So the 800 code, I think I have that code, but I only have one copy of it. So I haven't had a chance to kind of take a look at it and see if it's there, but the changes were small enough that I'm not too worried about it. You know, the core interest is actually there.
Nice. So it sounds like you still have an 800 that you can hack on.
I do have one. I haven't booted it in a while. The way that I got these disks, so this is actually kind of an interesting story too. I used these weird, so the Atari 800 had a very slow serial drive. The floppy disk was you know, super slow. And there were a lot of third-party modifications that people had built to kind of speed it up. And one of the modifications that I had purchased and I used for all my development time was because at that time the IBM PC was starting to come out. And so the popular sort of physical hardware at the time, they called them the MFM drives, and that's what those, you know, 5 1/4 inch drives in the IBM were. Somebody basically figured out how to take those guys and then build a special board that plugged into the 800 cartridge slot and then hooked up one of these drives to it. So it gave it really fast access. And also quadrupled the storage space of the disks. That's what the game was all stored on. So when I actually pulled all the data off, and this was given to me by another friend, he found an IBM PC piece of software that worked with MFM drives that could read that Atari format. So I actually just extracted all the data off of the disks using an IBM. So that was kind of interesting. I didn't have to actually use the 800 to kind of pull it apart. And then that machine also, we had set it up with serial ports, and so I could transfer all the data over and get it off the machine easily enough. So, and I don't have any of that old hardware. All I have is just the sort of stock 800 with a drive, just to have it.
Yeah. It's fun. So after Ford Apocalypse, how did you get to Dimension X? Whose idea was it? Did it come? Was it just jump right into it right away, or how did you get there?
So Dimension X was another interesting hybrid of people. At the time. While I was working on Slime and Ford Apocalypse, Steve Landrum decided that he wanted to try his hand at doing video games that were not console or not 2600 based. And so I introduced him to Igor, and so they started working on this idea. And Steven is he's a brilliant mind. And he really took to the Atari hardware, and he's the one who created the algorithms and the trick that Dimension X is, this sort of weird kind of parallaxed, you know, scrolling, you know, that turned into these diamond patterns. And he just started working at it and, you know, making some progress. He made it super smooth. He sort of proofed the prototype hardware, prototype software. And then he decided that he didn't want to finish it. He wanted to just go work, do something else, go work at Epix or wherever his next, you know, phase of his projects were. And so they had the name. They might have had the name. Igor asked me to kind of take it over. So I just took it on And then we worked on it for a long time. It was a really difficult game to build, and it didn't really come out that well. It actually was my first lesson in a failure of something that was fun. And that game took almost a year to build, and which was at the time, you know, way too long, right, for that kind of, or for that platform, and for the you know, what you got out of that. And a lot of that was the ended up being a lot of the restrictions, you know, because it wasn't fully 3D. It wasn't really even 2D. It was, you know, some combination of. And so you had to make, user interface kind of work with it. You had to kind of, you know, create this fakeness around how 3D worked. You didn't have a performance to really do 3D real. So you had to kind of do a lot of tricks to kind of make it work. And, and so that just took a long time to kind of get like even resemblingly correct. And and then, you know, both of you and I struggled on, you know, making the game, you know, interesting and fun. The basic idea that I came up with was, which was our sort of template, was, if you remember from the early computer days, the idea of a game called Star Trek. Had like sectors that you had to kind of go through and clear out the
get the Klingons in different sectors.
So that was the template for Dimension X. Hmm. So and that was also the beginning of something that I still do today when I do game design, is I think about games as templates. And maybe a dozen or two of these templates in all game designs.
For instance, tell me three or four. I mean, just give me an idea of what you mean.
So, three or four. So, Pong, tennis, you know, sports games, they're roughly the same kind of notion. Right? That's one template idea. Mario Brothers is another template, right? So the platformer games, right? We know them by another term, genre, right?
Right,
so,
okay.
You know, first person shooters and, you know, and all that. But at the time we didn't have
I see what you mean. Okay. Right.
So that's what I'm, so for me, I didn't, you know, the genres didn't exist, so I just created my own terms, right, which is where the word template comes from. So, 4Pocalypse was a scrolling side shooter, right, and it was one of the first, not of the entire games industry at that time, but it was one of the first on that platform. You know, there were many examples. I mean, I took a lot of my inspiration from stand-up video games, coin-op games. That's where I spent a lot of my afternoons as a you know, teenager and early adult. And those guys were the ones truly kind of, you know, defining these templates. And I pretty much think if you think about it, you can actually take any modern game, Grand Theft Auto, and just roll it back to a coin-op template. Not to say this is bad, right? I'm just something. It's just an interesting observation. So, whenever I do game design, I try to think about the template, and sometimes I'll blend them. I'll take a template and take a twist into it, and combine two different things with it, which makes it interesting. I haven't done games in a while, and now my last game was a twist on real-time strategy and sort of cute and cartoony, and it couldn't find an audience, right? And so that sort of makes it sad, right, that I was unable to kind of create, you know, my particular twist of game design and style.
And what game are you talking about?
I'm talking about my squirrel game called Squirrel Wars, and it is it's totally cute, totally interesting. It's real-time strategy. It's very accessible, and you know, it runs on iPhones. It's an iOS game, and it was a lot of fun, right? A lot of fun to build, but you know, the hard part, right, is that it's, you know, we as the whole games industry has changed so much that there's sort of these basic templates that everybody wants, and they just can't quite, you know, figure out what they, you know, they can't. It's hard for them to kind of adopt new things, which I think in any medium that just happens. That's just the way it is. I have no, and this is the nature of creativity. You know, creative ideas is that not everything works well, and that's fine. That's the way it is, right? And so that makes it, you know, interesting. The Slime as a template, right? It's one of the very first. That game was Missile Command. So if you think about that, it's totally Missile Command. Fort Apocalypse is a combination of Defender and Scramble, if you remember Scramble. And a few people figured that out over time, right? And Dimension X was Star Trek. And then, you know, every other Synapse game that we saw was had a template, you know, root, sort of, if you take the sort of linguist approach, the etymology of the game, right, the root game, you can find it.
Right. I'm sad you were disappointed with Dimension X, because, well, honestly, I don't remember playing it back in the day, but I've just like been reviewing the YouTube video of it. It's like Ball Blazer, which came out years later than this,
yep.
But like on Ball Blazer on LSD, and then
yep.
It looks amazing, and then you think, okay, we're going on this grid, and all of a sudden you go through this tunnel, and then it really gets trippy, and it's like, it looks amazing. I don't know if it's any fun or not, but...
Well, you're exactly right. That's the problem, is that, you know, so Ihor and I, our combination of personalities, we enabled that hallucinatory aspect of games. Right. Really early on, I figured out a philosophy of my thinking about game design that I shared with Ihor, and he agreed with, which is, I don't want to build a game that I can do outside. Right. So that means that everything I do, there's sort of a surreality, surrealness to it that makes it sort of interesting. Right. And so, you know, for Apocalypse, who would ever fly a helicopter underground? Right.
Right.
You know, and Dimension X is sort of like, you could literally think about it as when you're traveling between these sectors, you're traveling through dimensions of walls. Right. And that's really what that is. So that's an interdimensional travel, not necessarily going through a tunnel in that sort of typical sense. And that idea is, you know, that was enabled by, you know, Ihor, you know, letting me riff with him. And it stuck with me. I love that way of doing game design. And it's for some, you know, I think for people who, like yourself and others who are appreciating kind of the weirdness of some of these old games, you know, it's great. But, you know, for new audience members, right, they're not quite able to kind of tack into it. Now, beside the fact that Dimension X wasn't fun, because Ihor had done, by that time, he'd probably been involved in 20 games, right? Where he'd like, you know, every aspect of at least 20 games. I had done at least two or three now, and we couldn't agree on whether or not it was any good, right? It was sort of like, okay, it was interesting. It's like kind of cool. We liked all this. Look for it. We, you know, definitely had that aesthetic that we were interested in, but the game wasn't. It didn't feel fun to us, and it's an interesting testament, right? Because it taught me a lesson about, you know, how do you know something is fun? And it's really tough, because you it's very subjective. And the way, you know, what I learned was that, you know, when you're deep into it, you need an outsider to tell you whether or not it's fun. And you got to trust that outsider. Because you get so close to it that you're like, yeah, of course it's fun, right? You never have the ability to sort of say, oh, this really is not that great, and how do I fix it? And so everything I did after that, I always had outsiders look at what I was doing, and that was sort of unusual. And because I had this kind of community of people that I worked with, you know, early in the Bay Area, and I saw them socially regularly, I would share whatever I'm working on with them. And I would get, you know, comments about, you know, it's like, okay, this is not good, or how about this, or this change, or whatever. And that was pretty encouraging, right? And of course, as the industry started really getting money, you know, a lot of money, that kind of idea stopped, right? Because it's tough to share when there are people who are not particularly trustworthy, that will just take your idea and run with it, which never happened to me, but happened to other people I know.
I just want to comment, you said a few minutes ago you would never want to play a computer game that you could play outside. my favorite arcade game right now is a 10-player game called Killer Queen. There's only like 10 of them in existence that because it's so huge and expensive to make, there's only 10 of them in public arcades in the world.
Right.
But it started as a game you play outside.
Yeah, no, you're misunderstanding. What I mean is I don't want to make a game like a simulation of football because I can go outside and play it myself.
Right, I understand.
So that idea that you have, right, where you're maybe using a game to kind of, you're using something in the machine, that's outside. That actually is okay, right? I mean, because that's another way to connect yourself to something internally, that would be unique. And part of this philosophy was a mechanism for me to think about. Not necessarily because I wanted to not be outside, right, or not work outside, but I wanted to create things that actually could never be done in the real world. It was a driver for me. And, the fact that you just described a game that you could play with 10 people in, I assume, 10 different machines outside, that's definitely unique, right?
No, it was like a field game. You run around like on a soccer field sort of.
Yeah. But it had some computer component to it, right, that was unique and interesting.
Originally, I don't think so. It was just people with balls and flags and, who knows what craziness. And then they were like, this would be a good video game. So, and it's a great video game.
Right. So I also have the philosophy that I'm wrong daily. So I'm totally willing to admit that that is maybe a flawed perspective.
I'm not even saying you're wrong. I'm just saying there, but there might be an exception to the rule.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
So did Dimension X sell badly?
It definitely did not do very well. I would say, but that was also the time the industry was starting to really begin to change a lot. And by that time, Electronic Arts had entered the market, and they completely changed the sort of quality bar and the expectations of customers. So prior to Electronic Arts' entry into the games industry, Synapse was somewhat rare that we had two people actually working on a game, right? Ihor never really, he never wanted to have credits. He never believed in credits for himself or his contribution, which I sort of understood it, right, because he was the owner of the company and founder of the company. But he definitely contributed a lot, right, to every game he touched. And you can see it, and you see this sort of thread of his style. And and I think people picked up on that, right? Solo developers of the time, their games were sometimes pretty great, but sometimes mostly not. And Electronic Arts brought, because of what Trip Hawkins learned, he brought the Hollywood studio system to the games industry. So the first set of games that came out, they had sort of their, stars, right? But they had a team of like 10 or 15 people behind them that did all kinds of things that were, that were needed for the game, right? Including asset creation, artwork, not to mention all the marketing and all the other sort of parts of the game. And that completely raised the bar. And, Synapse was, the industry had been changing quite a bit anyway, and I think that pretty much hurt Synapse's ability to kind of do it because we couldn't compete. We couldn't really compete with their quality level. Some of the games, like one of the first ones, the seven, one of the very first games, seven, the Aztec Sevens or Seven Mines, whatever it is. I don't remember what it was called.
Seven Cities of Gold.
That's it. Yep, and that. That was, when I started playing that, when that first came out, I just stopped for a week. It was so amazing. Like, that raised the bar in my mind to the point where it's like, I don't even know how to compete with this. And then they just kind of kept going, right? Mule was another one. Mule's a great game. One of those sort of masterful games that had a definitely enigmatic, visionary behind it. But there was a team. There was always a team of people that kind of helped contribute and build those games.
So was Mindwheel next?
Yeah, so right after that, Mindwheel was the next phase. So as the industry was beginning to change, Infocom was sort of succeeding a lot, right? There was a huge market for that world, for these sort of text-based games. And we were, you know, coming from academia, right? It didn't take him long to kind of realize the opportunity. And, you know, it was myself and then William Ataga basically in his office convincing him that we could do it. We could build something that could be very, very interesting. And all we needed to do was find, you know, writers, right? And, you know, both William and I agreed that, you know, we needed to have people who were in their medium, right? And so he just, out of the blue, his first one, he called UC Berkeley and just said, hey, let me talk to, you know, your poetry department or your literary department. And Robert Pinsky was there working. You know, he was just a professor in residence. And he'd never used a computer. So Ihor and him just got along. And, you know, the surrealness of, like, Ihor's perspective just totally clicked with Robert, right? Robert had a, you know, his imagery and visions and the way his prose was so sort of a perfect fit. So they clicked together. They were also similar age. And so they brought him in for an interview. And then he and I met, and William met him as well. And he went back with some homework to come up with a couple of ideas. So he created like three or four ideas, just, you know, wrote a couple of paragraphs and he pitched them. And mine was the one that actually everybody liked the most. And we thought, well, William and I thought we could actually make that one work over some of the other ones a little easier. And so we started this sort of grand adventure and, where, you know, A, we were not only were we, you know, sort of inventing early computer science, you know, virtual machines and object-oriented programming and database engineering and all this kind of really, you know, I didn't really learn the real terminology for this stuff until a decade later. Robert had never used a computer. He wrote everything by pen and paper and a typewriter. So when we got things working, you know, he'd come to the office once a week. And we actually, one week, we got it working. We had him come in. We had him sit down. And he could actually type and interact with the prose that he wrote. And you could see his mind just kind of being blown.
Imagine that would be wild for see that for the first time.
Yeah. And, you know, and it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And, and he went on to kind of do, you know, really interesting things, and still, you know, still a sort of fascinating writer. And one of the books that he wrote, Heart Like a Mind,
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's that book. The one he flatly denies that it has any relationship to Mind Wheel. But it actually is, they are similar. He wrote, he was working on them around the same time. There's a space, right? A sort of a mental space. Like when I read that book and after spending a year working with his Mind Wheel text, it all had the same kind of, you know, color to me. You know, it was all same kind of tone and color.
History of My Heart?
That's it. That's it. Yep.
I didn't know that. I had to Google that. So how did you and Mataga work out the who did what in Mind Wheel? This is, sounds like your first programming collaboration, maybe.
Well, so Synapse was definitely, you know, as programmers, we were kind of independent and we would share, but only if there was sort of chemistry or connection or, you know, friends, right? Because it was a royalty relationship, you know, people wouldn't go too far with sharing because then you'd have to change the royalty deals, right? And not everybody wanted to do that. So Mataga was one of those folks, right? He didn't really want to help unless he made sure he got paid. And I can totally understand that and, you know, value that perspective. He was also, I would say, out of the whole cadre of Synapse engineers and artists, one of the most well-educated in the methodology of computer science. He had actually finished college at UC Berkeley, I believe. I started college and never finished. I was pretty much completely self-taught. And And others, around my, the same time were either similarly taught or just barely kind of finishing college. So the idea of actually taking on Infocom was Mataga's. We all loved those games. We played them a lot. But he figured out the way that you do this is you build a virtual machine. That was his sort of contribution. So what he really brought to the party was, okay, he built a virtual machine that could run on any platform. He defined the opcodes. He defined the tools. He built the compilers. He built the debuggers, right? And he kind of built the structure that where we could write code on top of this environment to build the game. And then he would build, if you think about it, like a little micro operating system to kind of do basic things, core object management and database management. He built some of those parts. But the actual story, like building the actual story and, the interactions and, making the game kind of work, that was left to me for Mindwheel. Each of the electronic novels model, there was sort of a tech lead, and that tech lead was the person who would actually do the game, right? Who would actually finish up the problems and so forth. And that put Mataga in a, from a business sense, right? He got a piece of everything, so kind of satisfied, something that was important to him. And he was able to kind of contribute in a really broad way that was really great, right? And enabled us to put these, like it was certainly one of the first things I'd ever seen where, we could build a game and recompile it and have run it on six different platforms. Pretty amazing at that time, 1984, 85. So it went from there, and it was really kind of interesting. And so my interaction with Robert Pinsky was a lot, right? We talked pretty regularly, and I really kind of learned how to be collaborative with creative people, and it's something I still do to this day. It's actually I'm a pretty good collaborator with technical people, but I really prefer and really enjoy working with creative people.
Nice. So that was your last game for Synapse, right?
Yep.
How did that end?
So at that point, Synapse, we sort of had this master plan. We'd take on the leader of the games industry at that time, which was Infocom.
Oh, yeah, how did Mindwheel do? I should have asked that
first. Mindwheel did pretty well, but the industry shifted because hardware started coming out. Like, this is before we had kind of, we're all comfortable with the yearly Apple upgrade for your latest iPhone being pretty awesome. That idea really didn't exist then, right? So when new hardware came out, it was sort of like it was revolutionary, right? New things would come out and it would completely change everything. And at that time, that's when the Mac appeared, and so the whole world just shifted away from these sort of self-contained, like the Apple II, Atari 400, 800, and they were really just game consoles. They didn't really have much of an operating system. They really had no notion of, a Finder, right, or a way that you manage things, right? They were very dedicated to very specific things, and the Mac and when Windows appeared, those completely shifted the sort of the whole industry toward a much more sort of general purpose world. Mm-hmm. And with that brought lots of performance, lots of power, lots of resolution, lots of all kinds of really fun, interesting things. And so Synapse was kind of caught in the middle of all this, not really being able to handle it very well. And they ended up being sold to Broderbund, right? And that's where we actually shipped the Synapse novels to Broderbund. And Broderbund was also in their own struggle. They were a little bit beyond where Synapse was, and they survived for another decade or so after that. But even they succumbed to the fact that they couldn't quite, be very competitive. The whole industry was radically shifting, and so it just sort of ended. I ended up, right after Synapse, I migrated to Broderbund, and I started shifting away from video games and doing more interesting, still creative, but sort of interesting tools. I worked on a reboot of an application that was really popular on the Apple II called Fantavision.
I had Fantavision on my 2C.
I basically was given the privilege of taking that idea and some of the math behind it, and I completely rebuilt it from the ground up and made it run on the Amiga. And the Amiga Fantavision is one of the more interesting ones because I was able to kind of introduce the notion of sound, where you could tune and manipulate sound along with your graphics, and ended up creating, you know, basically a keyframe animation tool that was a precursor to Macromedia Director, if you remember that technology. So you could create very sophisticated, interactive kind of like files that you could share that were ran on the Amiga. And that did okay, but the Amiga just did not get a lot of traction. It kind of fell away pretty fast. Desktop publishing kind of made it very obvious that both Windows and Mac were the successors, and then pretty much thereafter, I migrated away from all of this sort of early computers into the more modern machines.
You're also credited on Beachhead 2 for the Atari.
Yeah, so that is probably because that's Access Software, correct?
Sculptured?
Sculptured, that's it. So Sculptured Software was... that can't be it. But the reason that is because another person who was one of the founders of Sculptured is Peter Adams. And he worked at Synapse Software, and he and I were colleagues, and we had a very collaborative relationship. So he and I would share ideas, even though we didn't get paid for it, right? We shared, we helped each other, we did this sort of things. He ended up creating the Zaxxon port for Commodore 64, so very wildly successful. And he went on and he started Sculptured, which, you know, in its own right, did a lot of really amazing games over a period of a decade or two. And so Beachhead, I think I helped him with something. Don't remember what it was. You know, he just called me up and he says, I got this problem and blah, blah, blah. And I worked with him for maybe a day. I might have even went out to his office and spent the afternoon there. I don't remember exactly the details, but I'm sure that it was something like that. And he just thanked me for that.
By giving you credit on the game.
Yeah. Yep, and that was common. There was a lot of that kind of thing going on.
Nice. That seems generous.
And it's something you don't see much anymore today.
Yeah.
Really, it's really interesting. So then I guess the next phase, the industry had started shifting quite a bit, and in late 89. Myself being involved in a bunch of different games, from that time, I started working on a technology that turns out to be sort of very unique, where I was basically, if you remember at the time, a lot of sort of musics and sound effects, PCM audio, and kind of more sort of digitized sound. It was very common on the Mac at that time, beginning to be, and it was also very common on the Atari or the Amiga, because those machines had the ability to play PCM waveforms. And I got into my head that I wanted to start creating audio mixing technology. And this became a passion, sort of a driving force for myself. I eventually reunited with someone I'd only kind of interacted with socially, Jim Nichols, who had been working on the same thing. So we joined forces and created, we started a company to build this audio mixing technology that ended up becoming basically the first MIDI synthesizers that you could play on personal computers without having specialized hardware. And it was all done with wavetable synthesis and interpreting the MIDI data all in real time. And we ended up licensing that technology to Apple. It became the first version of the QuickTime Music architecture. And then we ended up licensing it to the B-Box, if you remember that. It became the core base of that technology.
Got one in my basement.
There you go. So that technology just took off. That was the big deal, right? That was something that was pretty amazing. We eventually got purchased by a company called Headspace, who had been founded by Thomas Dolby. And that ended up turning into Beatnik. And then we licensed that to Sun, so it became part of that, became JavaSound. So it just started ballooning everywhere. And then we, you know, kept progressing with it. We did this crazy thing with sonifying the web, where we basically created what is now really common, sort of web, the web audio APIs. We effectively had that kind of thing with a specialized plugin early in the browser world. And we didn't get a lot of traction. We got a lot of headlines, but didn't get a lot of traction. And then we, in 1999, we licensed it to Nokia, and it became their ringtone engine for all the Nokia cell phones. So, and then that just, you know, ballooned it to the billions, kind of, you know, where every cell phone had that, needed to have something like that. And then this was all before MP3 and that world, right? So once MP3 came out, our technology became totally uninteresting. Because our stuff was hard, right? You had to be a craftsman to make anything sound good. And, you know, MP3 is like, well, I can just record.
Right.
It's great, right? I mean, it's... it's not that we didn't see it coming. We were all, you know, we all had become audio nerds, so we knew it was coming, and we never really were able to kind of take advantage of it that much.
And now you do something called Igor Labs. You want to tell us about that?
So Igor Labs, it's had a couple of different incarnations. The first version of it was what the company that Jim Nichols and I created when we first started our technology. When we sold it all to Headspace/Beatnik, the name is the only thing I preserved. Everything else we sold. So I restarted that company in 2010 as basically a consulting firm and a loose collaboration of people that I have worked with that kind of believe in this idea of like working together and kind of creating interesting ideas and projects. You know, so it's kind of like this ad hoc come and go, right? So when we all kind of when an idea strikes and we're interested in it, we can kind of quickly assemble and have a company behind us that we can kind of assemble behind and then push forward and produce a product. And, we've produced a couple of different things with that. And one of them was this real-time strategy game, Squirrel Wars. Right now we're just, you know, we're all busy doing other things, so there's nothing else quite in the oven. But lately my interest, I mean, I've really gotten into doing mobile phones and Bluetooth technologies, and then the weirdly named Internet of Things. I'm also in that space too. I was part of Nest and worked on the actual smart thermostat and worked on the UI and worked on the learning algorithms and the machine learning technology around that. And now I'm part of a company that does a smart plug that you put it in your wall socket and you can control it with your app, control it with your phone. So it's a lot of fun, and it's very different, but at the same time, incredibly creative. You know, lots of technical, lots of, all the skills I've had over the sort of lifetime of experiences come to bear. There's rarely any wasted experience. Pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, nice. So thinking back to the older stuff, the Atari stuff, what haven't I asked you that I should have?
That's a good question. What haven't you asked? I guess you got most of the details, right? Most of the things, there's little dramas, right? I mean,
oh, tell me a drama story. Tell me.
So, okay. So I'll tell you the one drama story that was It was the beginning of the end of Synapse that I have a very distinct memory of. So the time was 83, I think. 82, no, it's about 83, summer of 83. So we were all working very furiously on the electronic novels, working on Mindwheel and putting that all together. And we had a company picnic, right? So this time Synapse was pretty big company. We were maybe 100 people, maybe something like that. And we had a company picnic at some fancy sort of historical house here in the Bay Area. And we were all just, you know, having a great time. And it was either Ken Grant, one of the founders of Synapse, or Ihor. They came up to me, and they were all pretty glum. And I started talking to them and had just found out, they had just found out that Atari, a company that was, years past, had $1 billion revenue, a public company, was purchased for almost nothing by Sam Tramiel. And it was clear they were worried. Jack Tramiel, you're right. Correct. They were worried that it was going to have impact because we had just, at that time, one of the things that Synapse was trying to do was diversify, and we were building Atari-branded applications for them, SynCalc, SynFile, and SynCom, I think, a terminal program. We just shipped, 40 or 50,000 copies, like the week before, and it was very clear. And as I talked to them, they were pretty much telling me that we're not going to get paid for this stuff, and it's going to be the end of the company. So that little drama basically led to the path where they sold the company to Broderbund, and the two founders, they placed a big bet, which is really, really interesting. They said, okay, you can take Synapse, all its properties, all employees, all people, and we don't want any cash. All we want is the outcome of the lawsuit, which they had initiated a little bit prior. So they took this huge bet that they could win, and they had a pretty good case, right? Very clear that Tramiel was not doing what was agreed upon by the company, and it took a while, and the company was long gone by the time it resolved, and it did resolve, and it ended up very well for them. Both of them did very well, but it was huge gamble, huge risk, and that's something I learned about these two guys, was that they were risk takers on a level that I had never seen before, and maybe even since I've worked with people a lot, new people now, and they're different. That's a different kind of risk taking, right? Definitely, these two guys were unique in that sense. So that's one. Another one. I'll tell you another story. That same party, Blumax. Remember the game Blumax?
Of course. Yeah.
So Blumax was a really unique game, and the guy who wrote it was this brilliant guy, and it was his first video game, his first computer science project, and it turned out that he had a photographic memory, and when we were starting to port it, so Peter Adams was involved in that game as well, and when we were starting to port it, we got him, the original developer, to give us all the source code, and he didn't use labels. He didn't use assembly labels. He used memory locations for all the variable names. So that meant that, look, you know, in his mind, location 35 meant vertical X of an airplane, right? And because he could totally remember all that detail. And I remember Peter struggling because he literally had to kind of reverse engineer like how this game worked. The guy who wrote it,
Bob Poland.
Bob Poland. Yeah. Poland was, he was, he was a smart guy, photographic memory. He was a card player, so he would actually go to Vegas and play cards, and he would win all the time. And so he wasn't really around, right? And so that meant that, you know, Peter, poor Peter, was, you know, like working on this thing for a while. He eventually got it, and the game ended up being very successful for the Commodore 64. But it was pretty tough. That so that party, he had came, you know, Poland had came to the party. You know, we didn't even know if he was going to appear. And that was the last time anyone saw him. He disappeared, and we're not exactly sure what happened to him.
Wow.
But he was a smart guy, amazing smart guy, really interesting. And all the sort of, you see these caper movies in the last couple of years, like 5 or 6 years, about people who go to Vegas with photographic memories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they capture it pretty well, right? It's just like, you know, in his mind's eye, he just sees the relationship of a number to whatever he's looking at, and you know, it's pretty remarkable. It's effortless to somebody that has that ability.
I'm happy to keep iterating on. Tell me a story, Steve, because this is working out.
Good. Yeah, I think that's it. I don't have any. I have to think about more of them. But yeah, you know, I think that'll. I'll give your listeners enough to kind of ponder for a while.
All right. Speaking of the listeners, if you could send a message to the Atari community that still exists, and you can right now, what would you tell them?
Oh, man. I would say keep iterating, right? The skills that you're learning by focusing on 65-2 assembly and understanding those problems are they will never go away, right? It's such a hard path, and you, when you learn this stuff really well, you take it with you in any sort of software engineering endeavor that you'll always write better code. You'll always think about the problems deeper. You'll always be able to understand everything down to the metal, right? When you're, you know, when you're writing in even in high level languages, if you started down this path, you just cannot help but convert your Objective-C or C code or even JavaScript down to the base, you know, microcode of a CPU. It just becomes natural.
I think that's about all I need. Thank you, Steve.
Cool. You're welcome. I'm glad that it worked out.
Me too.
And let me know. You know, love to hear more about what's happening in the community. So when you see the you know, when the first person wins the race, I definitely want to know about it.
I'll let you know. Cool. And yeah, if you need any, if I can help you in any way with getting that other source code out in the world, normally I would say send me the disk and I'll transfer them, but you've got them in some weird format and I can't really help with that.
Yeah.
The community would love to see your stuff out there as well.
Okay, great. Well, I'll keep that in mind, and you know, maybe I do have some stuff that are in normal Atari formats, so I'll try to take a look.
Great. So,
thanks for the time, Kevin. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Bye now.
If you enjoyed these interviews and would like to contribute something, I encourage you instead to donate to one of our favorite organizations, the Internet Archive, at archive.org. The Internet Archive is a nonprofit digital library with the stated mission of universal access to all knowledge. They've done incredible things to preserve computer history, including hosting thousands of programs in an in-browser Atari emulator, creating the Wayback Machine, and offering full-page scans of countless Atari computer books and magazines. Make your tax-deductible contribution at archive.org/donate.